Good afternoon. So I'll be taking over for the next couple lectures, and then we'll probably switch back to Dana Rem. So last time, we talked about condition codes. So the zero flag, the sign flag, the carry flag, and the overflow flag. And we learned that these are what jump less than, jump greater than, and so on use, that it's not the case that they like look backwards for the compare instruction, that the compare instruction, and it turns out all arithmetic instructions set these hidden registers, and that's what things like jump less than read. We also have the trickiest of them was probably the carry flag and the overflow flag, and ones people have the most trouble figuring out, is this going to be set, is it not? The way I like remembering it is the carry flag is, did I get the wrong result treating things as unsigned? The overflow flag is, did I get the wrong result if I'm treating things as signed? We also looked at this computed jump. And what this does is it computes the address x1234 plus rax plus rbx times 8. It reads memory there, and based on the value it reads, it goes to the address it reads. And we'll see an example of this in a bit, because it's something which comes up in the BOM lab, so it'd be nice to show you like typical usage of why we're talking about this and why it's actually exists as an instruction. We went over converting loops and if statements to C using the strategy of converting it to a form with go-tos, and then we had something where we could just do some very mechanical line-by-line translation where basically every line was either an instruction or like a sequence of instructions that of like compare then jump less than or something like that, which was very simple and didn't require like looking at any of the context of the program beyond those lines we translated to if and go to. We also started talking about pointer arithmetic in C. So we had this general idea that if we have a pointer, we can add stuff to it. We can just write pointer plus something or pointer minus something. And if we add x to a pointer, our C compiler looks at, well, what is this a pointer to? And advances that pointer by x units of whatever it points to. So if we have a pointer to ints and we add 2 to it, it advances the pointer 2 ints forward in memory. Adding 2 times the size of an int, on our machines that would be 2 times 4 is 8. And this means that if we have a pointer that points to the middle of an array, or the beginning of an array, that taking that result of that arithmetic is the same as accessing the appropriate element of the array. And this holds true as far as what the definition of this array index syntax is. And I believe we also briefly saw that if we take an array and assign it to a pointer, that's the same as taking a pointer to the first element and assigning it to the pointer. So any questions on any of this stuff we covered last time, I hope? Yes?
I just have a more general question about like how compare works.
Okay.
So the statement like compare 7, 5, is that going to be less than or greater than?
So the question is, what direction is compare? And part of this is, so the rule is that if we have comp A, B in AT&T syntax, this is the same, this does the same thing, well in general, this does the same thing as A sub AB. So in AT&T syntax, this means that we compute, is that we would do B equals B minus A, because it's a compare instruction, we just forget about this assignment, but we're doing the same computation. And so it's based on the result of that, and the rule is that JLE is, and this is the result, is R less than or equal to 0, J greater than is R greater than 0, and so on. They all, you can think of this comparing to 0. Other questions on things we covered before? Okay, so I have First, we'll do a brief logistical thing because we're going to start having quizzes, starting with a pre-quiz for next week. So for next week, there is a quiz on the stuff we are covering that week, which should be based on the small amount of reading for next week. And this is linked off the Quartz website. At the top, there's like links for home, schedule, and one of them is quizzes. And this will take you to a web page, which will look kind this window. Kind of like this, except it will have different quizzes on it. They won't be called example quiz for obvious reasons. A little website that looks like this. And each quiz has a time that it opens and it closes. For our pre-quizzes, they'll be available Saturday and they'll close 12:15 p.m. on Tuesday. That time is chosen because it's before the first lecture of this class, and we don't want people doing the quiz during lecture because that's really annoying if you're trying to give a lecture. And the way it works is that you'll go to this website, you'll click on the quiz you want to take, and when you start it, you'll have a time limit. And generally, our time limit's going to be 90 minutes. And so what it looks like is I press to start the quiz. It asks me if I really want to do it. It's asking me this because this starts my timer. Once I start, I have 90 minutes to complete it. And you'll get something that looks kind of like this with multiple choice questions. Some will be select all that apply, some will be select one. And you can fill in the questions. And as you do so, you select an answer. The box around it should turn green. And if it turns green, that means your answer has been recorded. There is no submit button. It's just we record every click you make, and the last thing that's there is what your answer is. There is a place to write comments here. So you can type in, you know, some comments and, you know, select your answer again, click save it. And that comment will be submitted, and eventually we will look at your comment and decide whether that changes the score we should give you for the question. Usually, our general rule is if it looks like you understood what the question was asking about, we might give you more points than you would have otherwise gotten. If it looks like you didn't understand it, we might give you less points than you would have otherwise gotten. Yes? So the most common use of comments is if you think the question is ambiguous, you should write in the comment what you think you had to assume. That would be the usual use. Like if you think the question like could be interpreted in two ways, you should write the interpretation you're using and we'll take that into account. Yes?
So we're not required to write comments?
You are not required to write comments, but you can. And we'll look at them eventually. The purpose of comments is to deal with that question, I didn't understand that question, or you know, I don't know, that could have meant two different things. That's where you write that, if you have something like that. Yeah, so the other case is if you actually don't understand the question, you can write in the comment your best guess, and we'll take that into account. Yeah. So what resources are you allowed to use? The quizzes are open notes, open book, open lecture recordings, and open internet. But you may not like ask specific people the actual quiz questions. Like don't post the quiz question on Stack Overflow, don't DM your friends or non-friends to see if they know the answer to the quiz questions. They are individual. But otherwise it's open resources. And yeah, you'll have about five-ish of questions like this, so you should have enough time to, like, even if you're looking things up in resources, that's kind of the point of it being 90 minutes. So, quiz page, so you have 90 minutes, as I said, you have 90 minutes or until the closing time. So if you start taking a quiz close to the time when it closes, we'll stop accepting answers at the time it closes. So if you want to have your full 90 minutes, don't start it, you know, 30 minutes before it's due. And when after a quiz has been closed, you can go to the quiz page and it will show you your answers along with the key's correct answers, and your quiz will be automatically scored based on that. Sometime later, we'll take comments into account. But if you're before comments are taken into account, you just do the automatic scoring, and if you got full credit, we'll not look at your comments to save us time. And it shows percentages next to each option. Those are the percentages of students who selected that option. So this is saying that 67% of students selected A for this question. And I guess one other note about comments and quizzes is that the letters, the answer letters are randomized. So when you're writing comments, please do not refer to answer A. Please tell us what the answer is, because everyone gets a different A. So any questions about quizzes? Yes, the other notable things, I showed you the box turns green. If your box stays yellow, that means you have a network problem, possibly on your end, possibly on our end, but it means your answer is not recorded. Turns green, it means your answer is recorded. Yeah. So the question is, what are the quizzes based on? So the pre-quizzes should be based on the readings. And usually when we list the quizzes, we will tell you what the reading is, but we mean the reading for the entire week on the schedule, like both classes. The post-quizzes will be based on lecture and or lab material. And potentially also the readings, but probably mostly lecture and lab. Any other questions? Okay, so, there. So, I told you I'd talk a little about this computed jump. So this is almost the most common use case for it. I thought I rebuilt these slides. And so here we have a switch statement with a bunch of cases. And a common implementation strategy for this is that we do one of these jumps where we look up a place to go to. So if RAX is 0, we take the address table and we look up the value in table, and that's going to be this pointer code for 1. Dot quad just means a constant number. The number is a label. Labels are addresses, so that's the address to go to. So if REX is 0, we'll jump for code for 1. This seems like I made, got to update this slide. And if REX is 2, we'll go to the next entry and so on. So this is how we look up in a table of addresses where to go to. And the idea is that we have a table and it points to some assembly code, and hopefully the way it works out is the table has pointers to the assembly code for each of these dot dot dots. And this is a typical way a compiler will implement a switch statement where all the cases are contiguous. This makes sense. So notably, the thing which some people get confused by is that this reads a value from table and jumps to the location that it reads. Like, it doesn't jump to the table, it uses the table to look up a place to go. Questions? We're happy. And I'm gonna do a swap. Yeah, that's better. Actually, updating my slides is better. Okay, and I meant to have the version where it starts at zero, because that's what REX is zero would get. Okay, so last time we talked about pointer arithmetic, so hopefully you remember enough from that that you'll be able to figure out what the answer to this is. I'll give you a minute or so. I would write things down, but maybe you don't have to. You can check with a neighbor, see if you both agree on the answer. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so you should mostly have an answer. So who thinks it's A, B, C, D, E? Okay, so we're all in agreement. Good, so I guess, so it is C. And I'll go through this very quickly. First, some notes on some other things here. So this is different than if I did this. So what we have here says is allocate an array on the stack and copy foo into it. What this says is allocate a pointer, point it to the constant string foo. So in the version that's written in the example, we make a new array that we can modify. If we did char star foo, equals the string foo, we'd have a pointer to some constant that we're not supposed to change. And the result would be that when we try to modify that constant, if we're lucky, things will seg fault. If we're unlucky, we might silently change the constant so the next time we run this code, it doesn't start out as foo. So with that in mind, let's go through this example. So we have the first line is pointer equals foo. This assigns pointer to point to the first element of foo. This is our rule on what happens when we take an array and assign it to a pointer, is it turns into a pointer to the first element. Then we dereference that pointer to set it to b. We increment it by 2, and the general rule for when we add to a pointer is we look at the size of the thing pointed to. In this case, it's a character, so we advance that this by 2 characters, that happens to be 2 bytes. Then we do pointer at 0 equals c. In general, foo of bar is the same as star foo plus bar. And this holds true even if you have a pointer, even if it points to the middle of an array. And so this isn't just an application of that rule. You probably, if you were writing real code, should write star pointer, because it's not really something you want to treat as an array, and you probably want to remind whoever's reading your code of that. And that equivalence works in both directions. So here we're taking foo, we're adding 1 to it. The compiler says, how do I add 1 to an array? Oh, okay, I can convert it to a pointer, that works. So it converts it to a pointer, to the first element, adds 1, gets the second pointer to the second element of the array, then we dereference that and set it to A. Any questions about this? Yeah. So the question is, would it be legal for me to write pointer minus 1 equals and some value? And the answer is absolutely, and yes, it will modify, in this case, the second element in the array instead of pointer 0, which is the third. Other questions? Okay, so some nitpicky notes on arrays and pointer arithmetic. One thing is about precedence, and I'm mentioning this not because we're going to test you on this, but because you might end up writing C code or trying to write C code that looks like one of these, or needing to read C code that looks like one of these, and you might be surprised by what happens. So the first one is not so surprising. If I write an array element, put an ampersand in front of it, that is a pointer to that array element. It doesn't take a pointer to the array and then treat that, and then advance that pointer by 1 and dereference whatever's in memory after the array. So that makes probably is what you want. Second one is where people get in trouble. So you might say, oh, I have a pointer to an array, so I'm going to dereference that pointer and then access some element of it. And that's not really what this does. What this does here is it accesses element 0 of foo as an array and dereferences that. For 0, this is the same. For if you replace the index with anything else, you'll be surprised. So if you want to treat foo as a pointer to an array, you should write this. So also, you can take foo as a pointer and increment it. And what this does is you might think, okay, I have star foo and it's being incremented, so I'm taking whatever foo points to and incrementing it. That's not what this does. This increments foo and dereferences it. It doesn't increment what foo points to. And the general rule of thumb is you don't need to remember which the precedence is, just if you don't know, use extra parentheses. But especially the second one and the third one are big gotchas if you write them without knowing which one they are. Very confusing, which is why I'm mentioning them in lecture instead of having you encounter them in coding assignments. Any questions on these? Okay, so things. So from what we've seen so far, you know, we can treat pointers like arrays, we can treat arrays like pointers. So you might say, well, isn't an array just a pointer to the first element of the array? And the answer is no, in some important ways. So to start out, we have an array here of 100 ints and a pointer to an int. And we can just assign a pointer to the array. And what that does is it turns the array into a pointer to its first element and stores that. So it makes sense. But the opposite, if you can write it, if you try to compile it, it won't compile. It's not legal. You can't reassign where an array with a pointer. The other big difference is that an array, you know, it has storage. So we have an array of 100 ints. If you ask the compiler, hey, what's the size of that array? It's going to tell you, oh, it's 400. It's 100 ints times 4 bytes per int, so 400 bytes in total. If you ask the compiler for the size of the pointer, it says, oh, that's an address. Addresses are 8 bytes. It's 8 bytes. The compiler doesn't care what the pointer points to. It's telling you the size of the pointer itself. Yes?
Is the size of the array calculated on the fly when you ask how big it is?
So the question is, when is the size of the array calculated? So for something like this, it's going to be calculated at compile time, because you know everything we need to know. Like if you look at the code that's generated, it's just going to have the constant 400 in there. So how about this? So what should that size of be? So say the size of a pointer, yes. So what this is this is a point, this is explicitly a pointer to the first element of the array. It's no longer an array, because we took the first element and made a pointer to it. So this should have a size of 8, which is, you know, equal to the size of an int star. Any questions about any of these sizes or things related to that? Okay, so since we're talking about C, I'm going to go to a different sort of problem you might want to solve in C. And that's going to be that, let's say I have a hexadecimal number 0xAB. So it's a 1-byte hexadecimal number, has 2 hexadecimal digits, which we'll all call nibbles. Nibbles because they're half of a byte. And I want to extract the first nibble, which is OXA. So I want to make a function where I give it OXAB and returns OXA, and the same thing for any other 1-byte hexadecimal number. So what's a way of doing this? And as a hint, you knew how to do this with things you knew before you even took 2150. Like, there's a very simple way of doing this. It doesn't involve anything we may have learned in this class or we may have learned outside of any classes. Bit shifting is a way of doing it. There's a way which is, you know, more commonly taught in programming classes that you have definitely done for other reasons. Yeah.
Mod,
in this case it's division, but yeah, we can just do arithmetic. So it's dividing by 16. We could also take mod 16 if it was more than a byte. That gets the top digit, it chops off the last one. We know division in C happens to round down, so we don't need to do any extra rounding. And this is something you would have learned how to do in any programming language, even if you never learned about bits. Okay. And this is a way we could write it, and arguably it's the most straightforward way. But let's, talk about, translating this to assembly. The straightforward translation to assembly is that we take our argument and we use the division instruction on it. And, well, we have a division instruction. It's one instruction. And even though it's one instruction, it's a bit problematic. The division is really slow. So, for example, on the Intel Skylake microarchitecture, which is only a few years old, and this is typical of the more recent ones, I'm just giving a concrete example. So division of 32-bit or less values is about 6 cycles. So a cycle is like a third of a nanosecond. So that's not slow by absolute terms. But compared to other things, it is really slow. This processor can do 4 additions per cycle. So additions look like they take like a quarter of a cycle. So, and divisions are 24 times slower. And this is worse if we're talking about 8-byte division. And you might observe that in binary, this operation is actually really simple. Conceptually, we have our hexadecimal value, we have wires for each of the parts of the bits of the value, and we're just taking 4 of those wires and getting their value. We're just taking the top wires and using them. Like, it should be much simpler in hardware, but if we do the straightforward translation, we end up with something that is really slow. And to not have to do this, we're going to end up exposing things like bit shifting to let us see that, yeah, this is actually something the hardware can do simply. We're going to give a way for software to do those things that are easy to do in hardware. So in hardware, if we have, say, hex 7.2, we can take R7, and it's on these top 4 wires, and we have the 2 on these other 4 wires, and we just use these top 4 wires and ignore the other ones. So this operation in hardware is free. If we have the value on some wires, we already have the top 4 bits. We don't have to do anything. We just have to ignore some wires. And we'd like to make it kind of close to that in software. We're not going to be able to achieve that. But we work a way of saying, if I want some part of a value, I can get it. And the operation we're going to provide for that is bit shifting. And this is letting us select some wires. And the basic idea is, I have a value starting a couple after the first few wires. I want a way of dropping 4 of these wires. So I'm going to have an operation where I say, I want to shift by 4, and I'm going to move all the wires 4 over. Now, this is an instruction here, and it takes a register. And, we have 64-bit registers, 32-bit registers, 16-bit registers, and 8-bit registers, but we sure do not have 4-bit registers. So if we're getting a result of this operation, it's not going to be 4 bits. It's going to be at least 8 bits. And that means that, we're going to have to fill in some extra bits. That we can't get a 4-bit result. We need to put something in those other bits because we're going to be having a result register that's at least 8 bits big. And we have to choose what goes in there. We can't put nothing. It has to be either 0 or 1. We can't just choose to leave them blank. There's no blank values in bits. So for this instruction, we're going to make an arbitrary choice. And that arbitrary choice is that the extra places we need to fill in, we're going to fill them with zeros. And this happens to be exactly what we want for the operation I showed here, this getting the top part. We want zeros in the top. This will do exactly that. And so we can actually write that using this instruction. So here, you know, it returns an int, so it gets a little tricky. So what we're doing is we're taking the low byte of the argument register, moving it into EAX. This is a move instruction that just adds zeros to a single byte value and moving it into a 32-bit value. So this is just taking one byte and moving it into a 32-bit register, adding zeros, and then we shift that 32-bit register over by 4. And return. And it's SHRL, L because we're dealing with 32-bit values. So any questions about this translation? Yeah, so the amount is the number of bits to move over.
And the right bits,
yes, they just go away. Okay, and we can actually write this explicitly in C. So the C has a shift operator, which is double greater than, which represents the shift option. So here's an explicit version of that which produces exactly that code I showed you, at least in my compiler. And you might say, okay, so this is a way of doing this faster operation that's better than division. So, you know, looking at that, you'd say, well, which one of these is faster? You might say, okay, well, of course, the shift version is faster. And if you did that, and then you like timed it carefully, you would find out, huh, they're the same speed. And the reason for that is the compiler knows this trick too.
With 01, then.
What?
They won't do it with 0, right?
They won't do it with what?
O0.
What do you mean O0?
No optimizations? Does it do this optimization?
So the question is, when does the compiler do this? What optimization levels? I haven't tested. I would not be surprised if this is done with O1.
Gotcha.
Because it turns out that this kind of optimization is very simple for compilers to implement compared to a lot of other optimizations. Note, however, that the reason the compiler could do this so well is because this 16 was a constant. Like, if we had value divided by some global variable, can't really do it anymore. So we've seen that we can use this shift to do division. And in general, we're going to be able to use our shift. In this case, we're doing times 2 to the minus 4, which is the same as times 1 over 16. We have this general rule, and you can see that, you know, it does some rounding. So when we take shift 1 over by 1, that's 1 divided by 2, we get 0. And move it over by 2, that's 1 divided by 4, we get 0. When we take 10 divided by 2, we get 5. When we take 10 divided by 4, we get 2, and so on. Some people look confused, other people look bored. Questions? So mathematically, this right shift operation is dividing by a power of 2 and then doing some rounding, because we can't represent fractions with integers. And with that in mind, I forgot the line here, so let me add that. Let's say we have this function, and what this function's going to do is it's going to take its argument, move it into EAX, shift it right by 1, and then return. Okay, so this is the assembly code for this function, and the prototype it has in C is it returns an int and takes an int. So if I pass negative 2 to this function, what is the result? So I'll give you a minute, check with your neighbor if you agree on the answer, work out what this should be. So, who needs more time? No one, apparently. Okay, so anyone like to volunteer an answer? Yeah. So you're saying 2 to the 31 plus 1? Okay. Any other answers? Anyone disagree with this answer? Yeah. So, or 2 to the 32 minus 1, okay. Yeah. 2 to the 31 minus 1. Okay. So, around the same area. Have a little, so we have agreement that it's some very large number from the people who volunteered an answer. Slight disagreement on exactly what very large number it is. Do you want to explain how you got at your particular number? Yeah.
So I said 2 to the 31 plus 1 because it's the bit representation of -2 would be 1 for -, and then it would be like zeros and then 1, 0. And then if you shift it over 1, then you move the sign bit over to maximum, mm-hmm. which is n minus 1, which is n being the bit number, and then the 1, the 2 switch just moved over to the 1 bit.
Okay. So anyone else want to? So this is the right idea, but as happened in the first lecture, we've all forgotten how 2's complement works. Not all of us, but many of us have forgotten how 2's complement works. So let's do a quick refresher of 2's complement. So in 2's complement, so we have 0 is represented by all zeros. Then we have 0, 1, all the way up to the maximum possible value, which turns out to be 2 to the 31 minus 1, because that's the maximum place, not 32. And then, when we add 1 to that, we get the most negative possible number, and that's represented by a 1 in the sign bit and all zeros otherwise. And we keep adding 1 to that until we get to negative 1, which is represented by all 1s, and we know it has to be represented that way, because when we add 1 to negative 1, we should get 0. So it turns out that negative 2 is the next thing here. It's going to be 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0. The other way you could have remembered that is the general rule, which flip all the bits and add 1, which is how you negate a number in 2's complement. And if you take 2 in binary, so we have 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, flip all the bits, and then we add 1, we get 1 plus 1 in binary is 0, 1, 0 plus 1 in binary is 1, and all 1s, and we get the same answer as far as what negative 2 is. So if we cross this out, if we take negative 2 with the correct value, and we apply the same logic, 1, 1, 0, so that's our actual value, and we shift that over, we get 0, 1, 1, and all 1s, like you expected. So we do get the most positive number, just happens that that's 2 to the 31 minus 1. And here we have our sign bit, which is what a 0 got shifted in, and that's why it flips sign. And so, this is our correct answer. Any questions on this problem? Or on 2's complement?
So I know that we can preserve the sign bit in FPGA programming, but can we do that in C?
So the question is, can we preserve this sign bit? Because gosh, this is annoying. Yes, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about this from the perspective of the operation we wanted to do. We wanted to, say, divide by 2. What does dividing a negative number by 2 look like in 2's complement? Well, let's say we start with a negative number. Let's first make it its corresponding positive number. So we flip all the bits to the number and add 1. And then we can right shift to divide by 2. Then we flip all the bits and add 1 to get the negative value. And what we're doing here, notice, is that we're flipping the bits, then flipping the bits again. So for everything but the new bits that we shifted in, everything but those high bits, these flipping the bits do nothing. Like, you know, we could have just right shifted. The only difference is the new bits we shifted in, the new value of the sign bit, gets flipped, except for some rounding. We have the adding 1, we need to figure out how to account for that. But except for some rounding, it's the same as right shifting, but shifting in ones instead of zeros. Ones because that's the result after we right shift and then flip those new bits. So this gives us a reason why we want a version of shift which will preserve the sign, as you say, and shift in ones when we have a negative number instead of zeros. And because that's a useful thing, we in fact have that. It's called, in x86, there's an instruction SAR. This is called an arithmetic shift. The other kind of shift is called a logical shift. And if we have a 0 sign bit, it shifts in zeros. If we have a 1 sign bit, it shifts in ones. So instead of shifting in zeros, it shifts in copies of the sign bit. Otherwise, it works the same as our other shift right. And in C, we have both of these with the same operator. So if you have a sign number, the arithmetic shift is going to be used. So here we have a int x, which is signed, so it uses the arithmetic shift. If we have an unsigned number, the logical shift is used. And when that shifts in zeros. So it does the right thing. I note that this is the behavior that happens in all the machines I know of. It's not actually guaranteed. Like maybe there's some embedded system out there which doesn't have an arithmetic shift instruction or doesn't have a logical shift instruction. And then it might, it's what it does with signed numbers is not defined by the standard, so it might do something different on that system. But every compiler I know of makes this choice. It's either signed. If it's signed, it's an arithmetic shift. If it's unsigned, it's a logical shift. So given that, so now we know this is an arithmetic shift. So what's the result when I pass -6 to this function? We'll review sometime. Think about it. And we're shifting over by 2. Which is some relationship to dividing by 2 to the 2, aka 4. Who needs more time? Okay, so anyone want to volunteer an answer? Yeah. -2. Okay. Any other answers? Yeah. -1. So let's work this out. So I told you that this is similar to dividing by 4. And if you know what this does in C, you say, okay, in C, this expression is definitely -1. Because the rule in C is division round towards 0. Let's see if the shift does that. So we have -6, so we have 1, 1, 0 is 6 in binary. And we flip all the bits and add 1. And we get 1, 1, all ones in front of it, 0, 1, 0. We shift that over by 2, and we get all ones and a 0 at the end, which is -2. So notably, this doesn't do what C division does quite, and this is because it rounds differently. And the basic difference is that C division, it rounds towards 0. That's what C division is defined to do. Arithmetic shift round towards negative infinity. And if you read my prior slide here carefully, I gave the floor operator meaning towards negative infinity, so I was being careful about that. So you might say, well, doesn't that keep the compiler from using this clever trick of turning my divide by 16 into a shift? Well, not really. So for example, if I write a function which just divides by 8, this is the code GCC generates for it with an appropriate optimization level, is that it can add 7 if it's negative, basically, to make the division round correctly. And this is still faster than using the divide operator, the divide instruction. Even though we're running 4, 3 extra instructions to do this division. So the question I'm saying is, well, if you're a compiler writer doing optimizations, to a large point extent, you prefer to division.
So you're saying I should do x and 1 instead of x mod 2.
So the question is, should you do x and 1 instead of x mod 2? No, you're maybe, but your compiler has the stuff figured out mostly. Yeah. So what's the purpose of the division command? Well, none of these tricks work for like dividing by 7 or dividing by an unknown number. And like, you could figure out how to do the division by an unknown number, like a variable that might be 16 fast, but like that's enough code that's gonna pay off to use the division operator, division instruction. And certainly for dividing by 7, like your alternative is gonna be slower. Yeah. The point of the first line of this assembly. So this is adding 7 to the first argument into EAX. It's conditionally used. So what this code does is we add 7 into EAX into the argument, store that in EAX, and depending on whether the value was negative or not, we either replace that with the original value or not. This cmove ns is a conditional move. We'll talk about that when we talk about YAD6 later. So it's a if then move instruction. So it's basically equivalent to a conditional jump and a move to skip the jump. So let's talk about the other direction. So we talked about taking our 2 nibble hexadecimal number, getting the top nibble. Let's take 1 nibble and gonna put it in the right place in our hexadecimal number. In hardware, this is, again, really simple. We want to add a bunch of zeros to something and run 0 bits. We just have some wires with no voltage on them and put it next to it, we're done. It's free. And you might say, well, you know, maybe we could just shift by -4. Unfortunately, that is not a supported instruction. But we do have a shift left operation, which is the opposite of shift right. And we do have a corresponding operator in C, which is, you know, 2 less than signs together. And this shifts in zeros. It always shifts in zeros. We don't have any tough choices because we're replacing the sign bit, so it's just always zeros. We're not going to have 2 versions of this, just 1. So this is our shift left operator. And this is going to be equivalent to multiplying by a power of 2. So 1 shifted over 0 is 1, 1 shifted over 2 is 1 times 2, 1 shifted over by, so 1 shifted over 1 rather, 1 shifted over 2 is 1 times 2 to the 2, that's 1 times 4, 10 shifted over 2 is 10 times 2 to the 2, that's 10 times 4, so 40. And this holds in general. We don't have any rounding to deal with, so this is simpler. We just get times the power of 2, except if we run out of bits, of course, in which case we overflow. And there's no exception here for negative numbers. Negative numbers work the same way for free. There are questions about this? Yeah?
How much slower is the multiply command?
So the question is, how much slower is the multiply command? Much less. Like maybe 3 times, depending on how you measure, but much less slower. So let's talk about a more complex operation. So let's say, given what we talked about before, I have this number 1F20, this 4 nibble number, and I want to extract, again, the second nibble. Now if I just shift over, I have all this junk at the beginning. So what is a way I could deal with this? And again, there's going to be a, there's a solution you could use which doesn't involve anything we've learned in this class, which just involves arithmetic, division, and other things that you've done before you knew bits existed. And of course, there are also solutions we'll talk about which take advantage of bits. In hardware, yeah, we just take those four wires. What's the what's a solution that will get us these bits in, say, C? So you could say we could shift left and shift right. So we could shift over, shift left to get rid of this part of the number, then shift right to get rid of all the extra zeros we just added. That would be a valid solution. So there's also the solution that you would use if you didn't know about bits, which is just divide and remainder. 256 here is 16 to the 2. So the first one, we divide by 16, that removes the bottom 4 bits. We take mod 16, that removes the top bits. Second one, we take mod 256, that removes everything but the bottom 8 bits, and then we divide by 16 to remove the bottom 4 bits of that. So the operation we really want to have here, we could do the shift left and shift right. That's a little awkward. We'd like some way of saying, hey, I'd like these bits. We'd like some way of exposing that to software. And we've seen the operator obliquely that does it, that we want to have a way of manipulating individual bits. And the way that hardware typically exposes that is that we're going to expose the simple operations the hardware does on each bit. And we saw those in our first class with gates. So we have gates, like, for example, XOR. These are things that are simple implemented hardware where we take two wires with a bit value and output a function of them on it. And we're going to start by talking about probably the most useful of these operators for like actual C code, and that's AND. So AND, let's make an observation. Here's the truth table for AND. And let's say I'm ANDing with 1. If I look at that line of the truth table, if I AND something with 1, I preserve the value. I keep the bit the same. If I AND something with 0, I clear the bit. And so we can use this idea that we're just going to construct a number to AND with, where we have a 1 in the places we want to keep the same and a 0 in the places we don't, and we're going to AND bit by bit to do what we want. And that's how we're going to do, this thing where we want to take these 4 bits and clear everything else. And we in fact have an AND operation that exists in C, which is bitwise AND, represented with a single ampersand. And this treats the value as an array of bits. So for example, 2 ended with 4. We say 2 is 0000010, 4 is 0000100. And we just go bit by bit. We say 0 and 0 is 0, 1 and 0 is 0, 0 and 1 is 0, 0 and 0 is 0, and so on. And for example, for 10 and 7, we say 0 and 1 is 0, 1 and 1 is 0, 0 and 1 is 0, 1 and 0 is 0, and so on. And if we look at the interpretation I showed you before with, we're putting a 1 where we want to keep things the same and a 0 where we don't, we can consider this 10 ended with 7, 7 saying keep the bottom 3 bits, clear all the others. Because 7 has a 1 in the bottom 3 bits and all the other bits are 0. And so by ending 10 with 7, we're saying keep the bottom 3 bits of 10, clear all the others, and we get 2. So questions on what's going on here? So if this is an operator in C, of course, it also has an assembly instruction. In x86, this instruction is called AND. So the way I did this evaluated this by hand seems like rather tedious. Like this is not a simple operation because I had to take each bit one at a time, but that's not what the hardware does. This is really efficient in hardware because this is what the hardware for doing it's going to look like. We're going to take 10 on a bunch of wires, 7 on a bunch of wires, and we're just going to have a gate for every bit of those wires. And all those gates are going to work all at the same time. So this is really fast. We don't have to loop through all the bits. It just all happens all at once. So questions? This is what the hardware is doing. So it's nice and fast. And we can take advantage of this to implement our extract that part without modulus or division and without doing the shift left to shift right trick. Instead, we have two options which are equivalent. So one here is I shift over by 4, and then I AND with something which selects the bottom 4 bits. And OXF, it has 1s in the bottom 4 bits. Everything else is 0. So when I AND with that, I'm going to clear everything but the bottom 4 bits, which are exactly what I've just put at the bottom of the number to get what was originally the second nibble of this number. Alternatively, I can AND with this value, OXF0, which has 1s in bits 4 through 8 exclusive. So it's going to keep those bits, set all the other bits to 0, and then we shift it over by 4 to move those bits to the bottom of the number that we just selected. So we actually get the result that we want, which is no. We want OX3, not OX30. For the OX1234 example. Questions on what this code does? And this compiles to pretty straightforward assembly, where we're doing an AND and then a shift. And this is considerably faster than doing modulus. So you might wonder, how do you do modulus in assembly? The answer on XE6 is you use the divide instruction to do a general modulus. So we saw AND. We also have a few other operations. So AND you can think of as we AND with something where we have 1s where we want to keep bits, 0s where we want to clear them. We also have OR. You can think of OR as, well, if we OR with 1, we're setting the bit always. If we OR with 0, we're doing nothing. So you can think of you OR with something to conditionally set some bits, even regardless of whether they're set already. We also have XOR, and when we XOR with 1, we flip the bit. When we XOR with 0, we do nothing to it. So you can think of XORing as conditionally flipping some bits and leaving the other bits alone. And so this covers all the common things you might want to do as far as like manipulating individual bits of a number. You can do them with all these operators. And all these operators work the same as AND. So our OR operator, again, it's bit by bit. We treat the number as an array of bits. So 0 or 1 is 1, 1 or 1 is 1, and so on. For example, 10 or 7 is 15. That's those bottom 4 bits set. Everything else is 0 or 0, which is 0. XOR, we XORing with 7, we flip the bottom 3 bits. So 0 XOR 1 is 1, 1 XOR 1 that flips the 1 to a 0, 0 XOR 1 flips the 0 to a 1, 1 XOR 0 is still 1, keeps things the same. Any questions on these? Yes. So the question is, if I want to clear a register, should I use XOR, should I use AND? I believe Intel recommends using XOR, and I believe the reason why is that that's special cased in the hardware, not because there's anything inherently better about it. So there's another bitwise operator we haven't talked about, which is a bit different from the others, because it takes one parameter, and this is complement, which is the equivalent of not. So we saw, or and is the equivalent of the and operator, that short-circuiting thing, but for bits, one bit at a time. We have the equivalent of not, so not, you remember, it takes a value and returns the opposite, so not of zero, zero is false, returns one, not of anything that's not zero in C is true, so that returns zero, which is the only false value. We have complement, which flips all the bits in a number. So the complement of zero is all one set, which as an int will be negative one. So yes, this includes the sign bit, that's part of what's complemented. Similarly, the complement of 2 ends up being negative 3. That's OXFFFFFFD. And if you do complements in unsigned, you won't get negative numbers, but it still flips all the bits. So questions on complements? And so generally, we're going to use these operators in ways like this, where we shift over to select to move the parts of the bits we want to the place we want them. Like in this case, we wanted that those set of 4 bits at the bottom, and we use one of these operators to manipulate them the way we wanted. In this case, we look at our list of operations, and we say, oh, we want to conditionally keep some bits, so we use AND. If we wanted to flip bits, we'd use XOR, and so on. So next time, we'll talk about some more things in C, and we'll talk about more tricky things we can do with bitwise operations. Meanwhile, remember, we have a pre-quiz for next week, and see you next Tuesday.